Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Case is on Hold, number 74. We're dropping in the middle of January. Welcome to the new year 2025. I'm Antonia Chen, deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction, and I have here
Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods.
Thanks so much for joining us and spending some time with us. Wherever you are, may the new year be bright. And this is sponsored by JBJS CME. Get your learn on, get your CMEs. Make your resolution be learning in the new year. So this is your time to get more information, and it's all at JBJS CME. As a reminder, these opinions are of our own, and they don't represent JBJS, the JBJS board, or anyone affiliated with JBJS. Without further ado, we're going to go to the top of the pile, What's New in Adult Reconstructive Knee Surgery by Luo, and it's permanently free. Sex Diversity and Equity Among Fellows of the American Orthopedic Association by Silvestri et al. Personal interest in this one, go check that out. Moving Orthopedic Patient Care Forward, Tips for Successful Systems Improvement by Bernstein, permanently free. What's Important, America's Wild Horses by Ghanium, it's permanently free. It's an awesome title, so definitely, hopefully, piquing your interest, so you go check it out. Advanced Care Planning for the Orthopedic Patient by Segal, Determining Maximal Outcome Improvement Thresholds for Patient-Reported Outcome Measures After Primary ACL Reconstruction, a Midterm Follow-Up Study Using the Anchor Method by Zhang et al. And Association Between Nail Type and Aseptic Revision Rifts After Cephalomedullary Nailing for Hip Fracture, Okiki et al. It's also 30 days free. And looking at fractures, the impact of cement distribution on the efficacy of percutaneous vertebra augmentation for osteoporotic fractures assessment with an MRI-based reference marker by Gia et al. And it's 30 days free. Without further ado, we're going to jump into our headlines. Please tell us about complete blood cell count-based ratios identify total joint arthroplasty patients likely to benefit from perioperative dexamethasone by Weir et al., and there's a visual summary for this.
Okay, so this is a study that was conducted using the Premier Healthcare database. So a data set that does use a lot of coding-based, ICD coding-based data, but does have some more detail as far as like lab values and things like that go, at least in the context where those lab values were ordered. And what the authors wanted to look at is complete blood cell count-based ratios. That's the neutrophil lymphocyte ratio and the monocyte lymphocyte ratio, which are inflammatory markers that are associated with postoperative morbidity in a lot of different contexts. So this has been studied in spine tumors, it's been studied in epidural abscess. I believe it's been studied in a number of different infectious parameters, both within orthopedics and in other surgical disciplines. And so, you'll typically look at the neutrophil lymphocyte ratio or the monocyte lymphocyte ratio when trying to prognosticate. It involves a measure of how much inflammation is going on, potentially frailty and things of that nature. So this is essentially, they're trying to do a diagnostic study in a way, using these parameters as informative for the outcome of interest, which is basically how dexamethasone modulates the behavior of individuals with these inflammatory markers across the spectrum of those inflammatory markers. So there's a couple different layers to this and a fair amount of intersection and interaction. So it would be the baseline patient, their inflammatory marker ratio, whichever one you're considering, and they considered both, then getting the dexamethasone, and then the outcomes, which is length of stay and postoperative complications as a composite measure. So they do have almost 33,000 primary elective total joints performed between 2016 and 2021. And of these, about 68% received perioperative dexamethasone. So my first kind of stance is that these are individuals who had like complete blood cell counts drawn for whatever purpose, standard preoperative workup, the day of surgery, anesthesia draws it, whatever. I don't think decisions were being made that the providers were actually looking at the neutrophil lymphocyte ratio or the monocyte lymphocyte ratio and then deciding whether or not to use dexamethasone. Just based on the number of individuals who are getting dexamethasone, I think this is more kind of like, you could almost consider it maybe a standard practice. And then there's 32% of the population who didn't receive it for whatever reason. Obviously, the majority of the patient population is getting this one way or the other. So you could consider that a plus or a minus for a study like this, depending on what your outlook is. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the length of stay greater than 3 days among patients in the highest NLR quartile compared with the lowest was significantly different. And then among patients with the MLR value of greater than 0.36, those receiving dexamethasone had significantly lower odds of postoperative complications. So you really have to get into the weeds in terms of like some unique and specific numbers and how and what the ultimate interplay may be. You know, at the end of the day, for studies like this, I think you can get some real insight into the author's outlook when you look at their limitations. You know, right in the first paragraph there of the limitations, they say, important to note that a preoperative CBC with differential may not be the standard of care at all hospitals or surgery centers. Although this predisposes the study to potential sampling bias, the large cohort size and use of multivariable models to predict threshold values minimizes the likelihood of insufficient generalizability. And that's not correct. So the use of multivariable models doesn't speak to generalizability. The large cohort size doesn't necessarily ensure against the potential for sampling biases. You can have a very large cohort where if it's all selected out, as you know, in some respects may be the case here. Now, I do think they can leverage and take advantage of the fact that people are probably getting dexamethasone as part of the standard perioperative treatment and not necessarily informed or driven by the NLR or the MLR, in which case this to some degree is a natural experiment. But I think it's a little bit of a stretch for me to envision that now people are just going to examine the NLR and the MLR and then make the decision whether or not they're going to administer dexamethasone based off of that. I think there's a drive to really, you know, get the maximum juice out of these healthcare databases. And once you've kind of skimmed the top of the absolute cream of what these data sets can give you, you then get this sublayer of studies where the premise and the approaches get ever more intricate and sort of involved. And that's because the desire to get more out of the data set is what's motivating the study as opposed to a question that really is, I don't think people are going to spend a lot of time when this is sort of part of the, am I wrong? Is this not part of the standard perioperative management in this context, unless it's somehow contraindicated?
That's exactly what it is. We're going to use this probably regardless. It's nice to know who's going to respond better, but it's like tranexamic acid. Unless it's contraindicated, I'm probably going to use it in every patient possible. And some may have less, you know, hematoma formation, but I wouldn't use it on someone just because they won't have as good of a response.
Right. And for those where it's like, you know what, this person is really going to benefit, it's not like you're going to use it more. You're not giving them a different dose of dexamethasone. And this study couldn't even examine exactly that.
Yep. Totally agree. So that's the hard part with these big database studies, right? They can't give you more of the detail, more information. Now, what it could be good for potentially is like predictive analytics for patients as we, you know, develop these patient calculators or things like that. Like if you do this, this, and this, maybe your pain control after a total joint replacement would be better or something like that. So these are all the types of things where potentially it could be really beneficial to have that sort of algorithm or information, but alone by itself would probably not move the needle in how I would clinically practice.
On to the next one.
Thinking other stuff. So this time we're going to talk about not all antiseptic solutions are equivalent in removing biofilm, a comparison across different orthopedic surfaces. This is by Chow et al. And three for 30 days. So for those who treat periprosthetic joint infections, we are always looking for the holy grail of antimicrobial solutions to control infections because we never want it to come back. I always say you can control infection. It's really hard to eradicate infection. And the reason is because typically we have biofilm or bacteria that stick around that you just can't get rid of. And previous studies have been done on hips and people have looked at components associated with hips not as much as the knees per se, and they typically only look at gram-positive organisms because those are the most common organisms seen in orthopedics. So this study is done through HSS, and they conducted a study to investigate which antiseptic solutions were most effective against methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus, or MSSA, and E. coli biofilms established in vitro on orthopedic surfaces typically used in total knee replacements. And this included cobalt chromium, oxidized zirconium, and polymethyl methacrylate, which is our lovely cement. So MSSA and E. coli biofilms were grown on these three different surfaces for 24 hours, which was immature biofilm, and 72 hours, which was mature biofilm. And the MSSA they used was specifically Zen 36, so they had intrinsic resistance to kanamycin, so they could potentially kill other bacteria besides the bacteria you just wanted to really focus on. So these sterile cobalt chrome, oxidized zirconium, and PMMA discs were placed into individual petri dishes. They fashioned these PMMA discs and they left them overnight, and they just, you know, took cement and mixed it and made discs out of them. And they took discs of other surfaces. Now, note that these are flat discs, which can grow biofilm surfaces. These weren't like implants with curvatures and things like that. They were immersed in 12 milliliters of one type of broth containing 1 × 10⁷ CFU, or colony forming units per milliliter, of either bacteria, and maintained in a static incubator at 37 degrees for 24 hours, again, or 72 hours, and they changed media every 24 hours. These biofilm coated discs were treated with control or various antiseptic solutions for 3 minutes. They basically immersed these materials for 3 minutes and saw how they killed bacteria, essentially. The solutions they looked at included 10% povidone iodine, a 1-to-1 mixture of 10% povidone iodine and 3% hydrogen peroxide, diluted povidone iodine, and the percentage they used was 0.35%, which was first popularized by Craig Dellavalle, 0.05 chlorhexidine gluconate, and a surfactant-based formulation. It's a proprietary formulation that has ethanol, acetic acid, sodium acetate, benzalkonium chloride, and water. And the control was PBS, or phosphate buffered saline. So following treatment, discs were sonicated to quantify adherent bacteria or underwent imaging with scanning electron microscopy to identify the biofilm. And on the MSS biofilm, each combination of irrigation solution and testing surface was evaluated in quadruplets. They had 4-8 replicates per group. Irrigation solutions that were effective against MSSA were then tested against E. coli in triplicates. Antiseptic solutions were considered efficacious, clinically efficacious, if they produced a 3-log or 1,000-fold reduction in colony-forming units compared to controls. And that's the FDA standard for regarding whether or not a solution is effective or not. The take-home message is on both oxidized zirconium and cobalt chromium, 10% povidone iodine with the 3% hydrogen peroxide eradicated all MSSA, meaning no bacteria left on these discs, and achieved clinical efficacy, meaning that 3-log reduction on the PMMA at both 24 hours and 72 hours. Now, you have to remember that PMMA has lots of grooves in it and porous coating, a porous surface and things like that. So bacteria can crawl into little spaces and things like that. So not surprisingly, you can get it off of a smooth surface like cobalt chromium and oxidized zirconium, but harder to get out of cement. The 10% povidone iodine did not eradicate all bacteria, but did achieve clinical efficacy on all surfaces on 24-hour MSSA biofilm. At 72 hours, the 10% povidone iodine eradicated all bacteria on oxidized zirconium and cobalt chromium, and it achieved clinical efficacy on PMMA. That said, the dilute povidone iodine, the 0.05% chlorhexidine, and surfactant-based formulations didn't achieve clinical efficacy on any of the surfaces. And the surfactant-based formulation only achieved clinical efficacy on the 72-hour MSSA biofilm on cobalt chromium and oxidized zirconium, but not on PMMA. And at 72 hours, the dilute povidone iodine and the 0.05 chlorhexidine failed to achieve efficacy on any surface. For 72-hour E. coli, the 10% povidone iodine with or without hydrogen peroxide achieved clinical efficacy on all surfaces. No other solution achieved clinical efficacy on either MSSA or E. coli, and DPI didn't have clinical efficacy on any of the surfaces at any of the time frames. So the take-home message that they said to do is they prefer to use 10% povidone iodine solutions with or without hydrogen peroxide to remove MSSA and E. coli biofilms. And this is true for multiple orthopedic surfaces, especially true when it comes to treating infection. And remember, this is not infection prevention. This is infection treatment. Now, all these solutions were less effective on PMA for the reasons I described. A few caveats and a few grains of salt. One, chemical debridement alone was what they were looking at. They took these discs, they immersed it for 3 minutes, and they took it out and they sonicated them. They didn't do any like pulse lavage. They didn't do any squirt bottle. They didn't do anything like that where there's a combination of mechanical and chemical treatment. And 10% is a really high formulation of povidone iodine. The commercially available povidone iodine that orthopedic surgeons use is 0.5%. The one that people use from the packet and they dilute it with 500 cc of saline is 0.35%. So 10% is really high. So they didn't obviously take into consideration things like chondrotoxicity or cellular damage because this is an in vitro study, not an in vivo study. So I would love to see this study in animals to see what the tissue damage could potentially be. I wouldn't put it regularly in humans yet. I wouldn't jump to that conclusion at this point in time. This is all in vitro data as the warning. But it is interesting to look at these different formulations at different rates and to see how they fare against difficult to treat bacteria such as E. coli and difficult to treat scenarios such as biofilm.
Yeah, I mean, well said. I don't really have that much to add. It's an interesting study, relatively well done on a challenging topic. I think you hit all the high points from my perspective.
Great. Not a case on hold. So we're going to take a look at your case is on hold featurette. Multi-center randomized clinical trial of highly cross-linked polyethylene versus conventional polyethylene in 518 primary total knee arthroplasties at 10 years by Salmons et al. There's a commentary, there's an infographic, and it's free for 30 days, so you have no excuse not to look at this. Highly cross-linked polyethylene was introduced in the late 1990s as a means of reducing wear and debris-induced osteolysis after total joint arthroplasty, and the real focus was the hip. One method of producing highly cross-linked polyethylene was by gamma-irradiating ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene, but the problem is that this led to free radical production. So because of that, second-generation highly cross-linked polyethylene inserts were developed in an attempt to reduce free radicals. And some manufacturers use sequential irradiation, annealing, or antioxidant stabilization to try to reduce the amount of free radicals. Now, people have concern that this highly cross-linked polyethylene has reduced ductility and fatigue resistance, which can potentially impact the performance of the material. That said, it's been shown that this highly cross-linked polyethylene is better in total hip arthroplasty in terms of improved wear characteristics when compared to conventional ultra-highly molecular weight polyethylene, but the long-term risks and benefits of highly cross-linked polyethylene in primary total knee arthroplasty is not as known. It's already been looked at in hips, but not as much in knees. So this is a Mayo Clinic-run study. It's a multi-center study within Mayo. It was a randomized clinical trial comparing implant survivorship, complications, radiographic results, and clinical outcomes of a second-generation highly cross-linked poly and conventional ultra-high molecular weight poly inserts in primary total knees from a single manufacturer with, in theory, 10-year follow-up. So the study included 518 patients with 518 knees who underwent primary total knee arthroplasty in these three centers. And all the patients underwent primary total knee for osteoarthritis, osteonecrosis, or post-traumatic arthritis with a cemented posterior stabilized tibial insert and a patella resurfacing. So they did keep all the components across the board the same. Randomization was stratified by variables with potential confounding effects on the outcomes of interest. So patients were stratified by sex, BMI category, and age group. They stratified these all numbers and they're allocated to one of the two treatment groups using a computerized dynamic allocation program that was hosted at the principal investigator site. The sample size was estimated on the basis of the primary outcome, which is the revision rate at 10 years. Assuming that the overall 10-year revision rate was 5%, the sample size that was required to observe 26 revisions was 520 or 260 patients in each of the two groups. They wanted to account for a potential 10% rate of loss to follow up within the 10-year period, and the target sample size was increased to 578 for a number of 289 in each group. Now, that said, how many patients were enrolled in each group? The control group at 254 patients, which is less than 289. And the ultra-high molecular weight polymethylene insert had 264 knees, which is above the sample size to observe the 26 revisions, but didn't hit their goal of 289 in each group. The primary outcome, again, was implant survivorships looking at Kaplan-Meier. And again, we looked at a bunch of different secondary outcome, and the radiographic evaluation was done by the Knee Society Rotographic Evaluation Scoring System. They stated that the mean follow-up was 11 years and the range was 9 to 16 years. It should have been a minimum of 10 years if they're saying that the follow-up is 10 years. Prior to the 10 years of follow-up, 16 of the total knee replacements were revised, 48 patients died, and 71 or 14% were lost to follow-up. So there are a total of 383 patients alive at the final follow-up. Now note, their sample size was based on 26 revisions, and there were only 16 revisions in the study cohort. The mean age was 67 years, the mean body mass index was 32 kilograms per meter squared, and 58% of the patients were women. The 10-year overall survivorship free from any revision was 96%, and from any reoperation was 94%. If you look specifically at highly cross-linked polyethylene, looking at the survivorship for any revision, it was 97%. And for our ultra-high-weight molecular polyethylene was 96%. The 10-year survivorship free from any reoperation, so not a revision, but reoperation in the highly cross-linked group was 96%, and in ultra-high molecular weight was 92%. There was no differences in the risk of revision or reoperation between groups. So I stated that there were actually 19 revisions, a little bit different than the number 4 prior to the 10 years of follow-up. The revision indications included PJI, which was 14 knees, instability, 4 knees, ORIF for a patella fracture due to osteolysis around a ultra-high molecular weight insert for 1 knee. There were no revisions due to polywear, osteolysis, or fracture in the highly cross-linked polyethylene group. There were 11 non-revision reoperations, including manipulation and anesthesia, arthroscopic lysis of adhesions, ORIF for a periprosthetic, knee fracture, and superficial wound revision. And if you look at survivorship free from any non-revision or non-reoperation was 87% for the entire cohort at 10 years. The clinical outcomes were similar, but radiographically, there were slight differences. They were not statistically significant, but if you're looking at the bone cement interface, there were non-progressive radiolucent lines in 2 of the knees that highly cross-linked polyethylene, which is 9%, and then 18% of the knees that underwent total knee arthroplasty with ultra-high molecular weight components had some non-progressive radiolucent lines in the bone cement interface. At the prosthesis cement interface in the tibia, there were no radiolucent areas. For the femoral component, the bone prosthesis interface had no radiolucent lines in the highly cross-linked polyethylene group, but 8% in the ultra-high molecular weight group had radiolucent lines. So in conclusion, their take-home message was that there was no wear-related failures in the highly cross-linked polyethylene group. There was one case of osteolysis in the ultra-high molecular weight group. In my mind, the difference between 0 and 1 is not huge. And so because of that, I would say they perform pretty similarly with regards to osteolysis and outcomes, meaning the difference is probably much greater in hips than they are in knees. It would be nice to see them reach the number of patients that they targeted. It would be also important, in my mind, to have true 10-year follow-up. So the minimum follow-up should be 10 years, not 9 years, with the range being 10 plus, not 9 plus. And the author did mention something interesting. It would be interesting to see the study conducted now where there's different alignment strategies, different insert types, different kinematics, all sorts of things like that. But that would require another 10 years. So who knows what we'll be doing in 10 years for total knee replacements. Any thoughts?
Just a couple. I agree with all the points that you raised, particularly if you're going to have in the title and you're saying it's 10 years, then it should be 10 years, especially if you're maintaining level one evidence. If the study was designed to have the primary endpoint or any endpoint be defined at 10 years, you then shouldn't have this notion of a range, a prospective, poorly controlled study, or even a retrospective review of prospective data. Now, I know that isn't the case here. They went through the NCT registration, all of those things. I do find it hard to reconcile level one evidence when you didn't meet the enrollment numbers. And then beyond that, the numbers that they powered for did not materialize in the data set. And I think that's particularly important here. If a little bit nuanced, nonetheless, very relevant to these types of determinations. So they present their power analysis, and their estimates were that the control group would have a revision rate of 5% versus 1.6% in the treatment group. And then they said that they need 26 revisions to be adequately powered. When you look at the results, they don't have 26 revisions, they have 19. And the reoperation rate was 96%, or rather, the overall survivorship free of any revision and from any reoperation was so there was a 4% reoperation rate in one group, 6% in the other, which, you know, falls into their benchmarks, but not with the numbers that they needed. They needed 26 patients. They only got 19. And when you're talking about a really small number of patients, and some people might be saying, well, I mean, they had 518. Yeah, I mean, that number is not what's important. We're talking about the outcome. So if they had 518 patients with zero revisions, you're not going to be able to make heads or tails of this data. So they needed 26. They only had 19. You say, oh, you're quibbling about seven patients. But when you're only talking about 26, that seven is quite substantial. And that's the way that I would look at it. So I have a hard time reconciling the level one evidence that is advertised for this study. There's a problem here of restricted event rate, and therefore that they're not really able to effectively measure the outcomes that they hope to.
Always can do better by enrolling more patients. All right.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Like, you know, an interim analysis should have said we probably need more patients because we're short these seven revisions, and that's the outcome of interest. It's not the total number of patients that you have.
Totally agree.
And I get, you know, that it's like, oh, well, but this is 10-year data, and it's, well, in every talking point advertising for this, when you actually, you know, look under the hood, peel back the cover, it's not exactly 10-year follow-up. It's not exactly the right number of patients. It's not exactly the right event rate. So when you have all of these not exactlys, what are we left with, really?
Case on hold?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that this is definitely in the you're on hold here for sure.
Well, anesthesia's waking up. Time to talk.
Well,
about
yeah, no. I mean, it's like you're coming and you're like, you know, the patient. You want to take them to the OR for the hip fracture. You don't have the CBC. They have a systole. They, you know, all of these things. It's not going to go to the OR. They're not fit for a haircut, let alone highly cross-linked polyethylene.
Unless their inflammatory markers are okay and they can get dexamethasone.
Yeah.
It comes full circle. All right, going to some honorable mentions. Volume and distribution of early knee effusion after total knee arthroplasty with a peak-based knee prosthesis. Correlation with changes in serum inflammation marker levels, knee functional score, and range of motion. By Liu et al., and it's permanently free. So this is an interesting concept where total knee arthroplasties are now being done with PEEK. And I love this intersection of spine and total knee replacements. And this was done in a small group of patients, but the idea was they really wanted to characterize early knee effusion. The 9 patients with osteoarthritis who are 59 to 74 years old underwent unilateral total knee arthroplasty with the PEEK prosthesis between June 2021 and August 2021. So a short time frame, just a month, and that's why there's only 9 patients. And there was dynamic early postoperative changes in the volume and distribution of knee effusions were evaluated with the use of 3D MR stereoscopic images. Serum inflammatory markers were also measured via a blood test, which peaked at 1 week, and joint function was evaluated with the use of subjective functional score of the Knee Society score and knee range of motion. And using this 3D MR imaging, the precise distribution and volume of and dynamic changes in knee effusion after total knee arthroplasty with the PEEK prosthesis were confirmed. And they did correlate with inflammation and joint function in the early postoperative period, which is not unusual given that total knee replacements obviously lead to some inflammation. There is some potential clinical benefit of the PEEK-based knee system for future use. It's not metal-based, which is an interesting concept given our tradition of cobalt chromium or titanium or other metals that we use in the knee. Open door cervical laminoplasty using instrumentation of every level versus alternate levels, a multi-center randomized controlled trial by Tamai et al., and it's 30 days free. In the setting of cervical open door laminoplasty, the question of whether or not every open laminar level should be instrumented has not been well investigated. This study found that skip fixation may be sufficient to achieve non-inferior 2-year postoperative improvement in myelopathy. Additionally, laminoplasty with skip fixation potentially can lead to improvements in terms of neck pain, neck disability, and quality of life compared with all fixation. 3D printed prosthesis with an articular interface for anatomic acetabular reconstruction after type 1 and type 2 and type 3, internal hemipelvectomy, clinical outcomes and finite element analysis by Huang et al. Is also permanently free. This is a retrospective cohort study including 28 patients with these three types of internal hemicelvectomies to the articular surface of the sacroiliac joint managed with a prosthesis at a single center between August 2016 and August 2021. The use of a 3D printed prosthesis with an articular interface for pelvic reconstruction demonstrated stable prosthetic fixation, anatomical acetabular reconstruction, and acceptable early functional outcomes. And finally, achieving better clinical outcomes after total knee arthroplasty in knees with valgus deformity, the role of alignment strategies by Battier and al. This is a retrospective study including primary posterior stabilized total knee arthroplasty with the preoperative hip-knee angle of greater than or equal to 180 degrees with a minimum follow-up of 32 months. There were 460 knees included, and there were three different groups. The first group was preoperative neutral alignment, and it ranged between 180 to 183 degrees, and there was 162 patients in that group. Preoperative mild valgus was defined as 184 to 190 degrees, which had 204 patients. And finally, preoperative severe valgus, which was greater than 190 degrees, with a sample size of 94. For preoperative mild valgus, correcting to neutral alignment achieved better outcomes and fewer complications than leaving residual valgus. For preoperative severe valgus, retaining residual valgus postoperatively ensured satisfactory functional outcomes without increased complications. So in your valgus knees, aim for neutral if their valgus deformity is between 4 and 10 degrees. So some food for thought. Thank you for joining us in this new year, and happy 2025, everyone.
But your case is still on hold.
Till next time.